A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sheila Scheuge, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to father and ultra-marathon runner, Ian Lawton.
Food was my thing. It could be alcohol for someone else, it could be sex for another, it could be violence, it could be whatever way you, whatever it is you use to numb the pain, to get through it, to burst through it, to ignore it, to put a band-aid on it, when the last thing you think of doing is just openly talking about how you feel. And that's what we're told not to do?
Yeah.
Fuck off, society. No, I, excuse my language, but I am done with shutting up, because it was destroying me. And my philosophy now is to speak up, not man up, because manning up is bullshit.
Ian lives in Navan and Meath, is married to Jennifer, and is the father of two sons, Ike, who's 12, and Hank, who passed away 10 years ago, the day after he was born. In this conversation, he gives us a profound insight into infant loss and the pain of a bereaved father. But not alone does he speak about loss and grief, but also about rebirth and moving forward with a newfound purpose. In just a year, he went from being morbidly obese to becoming an extreme runner, which led him to running 10 marathons in 10 days, finishing on what would have been Hank's 10th birthday this February. This September, he turns 50, an age he wasn't expected to live to see, and he'll mark it by embracing the challenge of the Kerryway Ultra, running the grueling 200 kilometres through mountain passes, bogs, roads and trails. This was a deeply emotional and challenging conversation for him, and I commend his rawness and his willingness to be real. I started by asking him what life was like for him ahead of the birth of his second son about 11 years ago.
Yeah, I guess it was an exciting time. We just moved out of the big city. Okay. Kind of our tail between our legs, really, because it was the tail end of the 2008 recession. You know, I think we stuck around Dublin for a little while, and I guess the recession pushed us out of Dublin, so we ran tail between our legs out to the country. And we kind of embraced going out into the country. Let's raise our family here, out of the big city, and adding to the family, obviously, was a logical step in that. And you know, expanding the family and the experience of being a parent, because, you know, being a parent is... It's the reason I exist, you know. Mm. It's a... Sorry, I wasn't expecting to get emotional early. But yeah, Yeah, so obviously, you know, planning another, expanding the family was you know, a joyful thing to do, you know, and we embraced that wholeheartedly. And pregnancy was going grand, you know. I guess I was in a tough place financially. I lost my job, made redundant at the tail end of the recession, about 9 days after my eldest son, Ike, was born. So I took on the role of the stay-at-home dad. So that was our circumstance kind of dictated that. And, you know, instead of fighting against it, I embraced it as much as I possibly could because, you know, typically the male role is to be the provider. And so, you know, you're at the playground with a boogie and you meet another dad and they're like, kind of miserable about it and going, you're seeing a lot more of us these days, aren't you? You know, post-recession.
Mm.
And I was kind of, no, let's, this is an opportunity.
Mm.
You know, this is not, you know, our fathers, our grandfathers didn't have the opportunity to experience this. So let's live every day to the fullest. And, you know,
yeah,
you know, you could change a nappy with one hand while you're getting the dinner ready. You know, it was, you know, I to be honest, I really fell for it. I really enjoyed it and went into it, you know. So, you know, to have another baby on the way was, you know, let's bring it on. Yeah, yeah. Bring it on. I'm kind of dancing around getting into the area of how they, you know, I guess it came to an abrupt halt. I had fallen asleep on the couch, watching telly. We'd just entered the third trimester by a good few days, maybe a week or two. It's really hard to remember exact, you know, dates and things like that. But I just remember my wife waking me up on the couch and I've fallen asleep on the couch. And it was, I thought she was waking me up, you know, to get to bed. But she's like, my water's broke. And I'm like, I don't see how that's possible. We're not even in that, you know. Are you sure? You know, I said, no, it's definitely the water's broke. And so I rang around to doctors on call. That was the middle of the night. You know, Ike was asleep upstairs, age two. And it was like wanting to get like, you'll be grand on the phone. Go back to bed. Everything's okay. But it was like, no, get yourself to the nearest maternity hospital immediately. So long story short, we found someone to look after Ike and tore into Dublin. And she was admitted into the ward of women basically ready to go. And what struck us was that their bellies were much larger.
Mm.
And Jennifer's, and we were just a little, you know, she was very freaked out. I was too, but I didn't want to show that. Mm. And she was being looked after, went home, brought Ike in to see her the next day, and everything was going great, big smiles. I took him to the Phoenix Park afterwards, and we were playing in there at the playground. And then I got a call from the hospital to say that that emergency delivery was the only words I heard.
Okay.
And I'm across town in the Phoenix Park with a 2-year-old boy, and I'm like, and home is in Navan, so I had to, you know, break every law to get him, to someone to look after him so I could get right back in. And I got to the hospital. I missed the birth. And I'm reluctant to go into too much detail, but it was an emergency delivery. I went into the delivery room and it was empty apart from Jay, and she didn't get to see him.
Okay.
He was taken to the special care baby unit immediately. So I looked after her as best I could, got her back to the ward, and I was invited then the opportunity to go up and see Hank. He wasn't Hank at this point yet. But I went up to the special care baby unit. She was unable to. And I had been in that room, in that special care baby unit, two years prior with Ike. Ike was about 2 weeks premature, and he had a little bit of a cough. So I remember being in that room 2 years earlier and seeing all the other incubators with all these tiny little premature babies and being so relieved that, because Ike looked enormous compared to the rest of them. And I was, I'd hate to be the parent of one of those babies. You know, that must be awfully traumatic. And here I am 2 years later, being led into the same room. And I mean, the place is wall-to-wall incubators, but before he was even pointed out to me, I knew which one he was. And the weird thing is about this pregnancy is that I was a little detached because I was so in love with my first son.
Sure, yeah.
That I thought, I was a little freaked out thinking I'm maxed out here with love. I don't know where I'm supposed to get all this other love from to give to this other kid that's on the way. And I was upset about that, and I was freaked out. I told one of my mates about this, who had two kids, two sons, and he says, yeah, I kind of felt a bit like that as well until the second boy came along. And as soon as I saw him in the incubator, the overwhelming sense of love that I felt made my knees buckle and I fell to the floor. It was so overwhelming, and just he was so tiny. And the doctor brought me up, and I sat with him, and it's the only time I ever had with him. And I'll keep that to myself if that's okay. But it was a beautiful experience, and I treasured that, you know. And I went downstairs to Jennifer, and I just gushed at how beautiful he was. Just gushed at how incredible he was. And I said, let's call him Hank. He needs a... Am I allowed to swear?
Of course you are.
He needs a fucking man's name. He needs a cowboy's name. You know, he needs like a Johnny Cash boy named Sue kind of
love it. Yeah.
Tough guy name, because he was so tiny. I figured he just needed all the help he could get, you know. That this guy was going to grow up to be just this hulking brute of a masculine man, you know. She's like, yeah, that's my dad's favourite singer, Hank Williams.
Hank Williams,
so
right.
Yeah, that'll do. So he became Hank right then and there. Hank Charles Norman Lawton, his full name. And once I went back home, I had to get back home, obviously, with a two-year-old boy there. I got home and I was just elated, you know, a new boy. And the love that I thought I wasn't going to have for him was like exploded into existence. It was overwhelmingly incredible. And I looked after Ike. I said, we're going to go in tomorrow and we're going to see your new little brother. And just incredible. And I don't know when was the last time I slept, but I climbed into bed that night. And just as my head hit the pillow, it was like the phone rang.
Yeah.
And it was Jay. They want you to come back in. Obviously, the shorthand of that is that come back in to, because he's not going to make it. So I had to find, you know, someone to look after Ike again, and like broke every law, hurtling back into Dublin. And I got there and straight to the special care baby unit, and just to see, there were just his incubator was surrounded by people and just fighting to keep him alive. He was very little. But he was so strong. I mean, I'll never forget the tiny little digits that held the tip of my finger and squeezed so hard. He knew I was his dad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
He knew it.
Yeah.
And it was surreal to be... Just to... You know, as a parent, as a father, you want to do whatever it is in your power to just help and make the bad thing go away.
Yeah.
And the profound sense of helplessness of like, let me do that. Let me squeeze the thing to make him breed. You're doing it wrong. You know, there's all these thoughts go through your head. You just want to scream, just rip whatever you need out of me. Just don't let him die.
Yeah.
But they fought really hard. And the decision was made that to take him off, to let him breathe by himself. And Jennifer held him and was able to say goodbye. The strongest woman I've ever had the honor of knowing. She just said goodbye with dignity, and I was just pleading with him not to die. And just, I couldn't. There was nothing I could do. Nothing. I hugged everyone in the room and thanked everyone in the room, and we went downstairs and they had given us given Jay a private room with a single bed, and they were like, we'll go get you a mattress, and they were fussing over me, and I'm like, no, don't, just look after Jay. I'm grand, just I'm not the one who lost the baby, she did, you know. And they got the mattress and I'm like, please, you're grand, just I'm okay. And they sat me down on the mattress, and that's the last thing I remember. I passed out. And the next morning, or however, I mean, I didn't sleep. I just lost consciousness.
Yeah.
And the next morning, I'm hearing all this chatter, you know, just hospital intercoms and things like that. And just for one tiny fraction of a second, I was like, it's a dream. Oh, thank Christ, it's a fucking dream, you know? And then the sudden realization of all these nebulous sounds that I was hearing, no, that's hospital. Oh, and I sat bolt upright, and there was Hank at the foot of the bed in the, you know, the maternity case cot that they have for newborns. And then minutes later, the doctor who had delivered him the previous day came bursting into the room with all the joys of spring, with a big smile on his face to see the new baby he delivered the day before. And clearly nobody had told him before he started a shift, and he walked in the room and he just threw his hands up and just went, no! And that just made that really... I was like, did nobody tell you? And it made it so much more real to see someone else upset.
Yeah.
And I was frozen in place, and I just wanted to hug him and let him know that it was okay, but I just couldn't move. I just stood there. I mean, that was the 2 days, February the 1st and February the 2nd. He was born on the 1st, died on the 2nd, and You know, so from one extreme joy to just having it ripped from your very essence the very next day is just, it was cruel. It was absolutely cruel. But the fact is that this happens every single day, you know. And we don't, as a society, want to know about this horror. We don't want to know. You know, when a spouse loses their partner, they're a widow or a widower. When a child loses their parents, they're an orphan. There's a language, you know, they're acknowledged. But bereaved parents, particularly bereaved parents of infant loss, we just don't exist. You're expected to, you know, what are you so upset about? You know, you didn't get a chance to know the person. You know, it's, you're supposed to, you know, there's a statute of limitations of how long you should be upset for, you know. But it remains with you every day. I mean, it's, that love didn't die the next day. That's still very much alive right now, a decade later.
Well, you can, I can feel it from you.
Yeah.
It's so powerful, and still talking about something so devastating is so painful. So
it's like it happened last weekend. You know, it's really, it's so vivid.
Yeah.
And but I mean, I did what society dictated for 7 years. I just, you know, I was supposed to, you know, man up and just get on with it and suck it up. And it destroyed me, you know.
Yeah.
It really destroyed me, just not only mentally but physically too. Where I sought comfort and solace was food. Almost to the point of gluttony, almost to the point of addiction. You know, it was, I ate covertly, I ate secretly. I would wait for everyone to go to bed and I'd get to the chipper before it shut and I'd order so much food that I'd be like, can I have another fork? Because I was too embarrassed to acknowledge that all this food was for me at 11 o'clock at night, you know?
Mm.
And I'd find a place hidden away and I'd just gorge myself and it felt so good. It just felt wonderful just to feel that sort of warm, comforting hug from within, you know, and it really just, it ticked all the boxes, you know, on a very sort of primal kind of level. And just really satiating and fulfilling, and that you just go to bed comfortably warm with that sort of almost borderline discomfort of overeating, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that over time, you know, damages the physical body, you know, it completely damages you.
So if you felt going to bed, say, after having, going to the chipper and having whatever you were eating, like be it chips, burgers, whatever, how would you feel when you woke up in the morning?
You'd kind of try and stay asleep as long as possible. You'd ignore the alarm clock. You'd hit snooze over and over and over again. You're defeated, absolutely defeated. And the hunger just never goes away. You're constantly feeding that hunger. And it was almost like it was impossible to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, it was always temporary, you know.
So behind the hunger was just sadness.
Just grief.
Grief.
Just unacknowledged grief.
Yeah.
You know, when in the aftermath, it was always a case of like, how's Jennifer? How's she doing? And like you'd answer and then you're like, it's my baby too. You're not going to ask how I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm fucking dying here. Yeah. And you just ask me how I'm doing. No one even think of it, you know?
Yeah.
Because dads don't lose babies. As society sees it, dads don't lose babies.
When you say that, it is... No, don't be sorry at all. Because I think what you're doing is a very selfless thing, having these conversations, you know, being so open through your experience because of the impact your pain, unfortunately... But your pain and your experience, but also your recovery. And now you are a source of huge inspiration for so many people. But by owning it and reflecting what you went through, and how society behaves differently towards mothers and fathers is a really important message, because we sometimes don't realise that we are conditioned to think a certain way, yeah. but we are, and it needs to change.
And even bereaved fathers are guilty of that conditioning too, as was I for 7 years, because, you know, I'm not supposed to be upset about this. I'm supposed to man up, you know, I'm supposed to be the strong, silent type, you know, I'm supposed to bottle it down and carry on, soldier on, you know. And it's so damaging.
Yeah, and you know, all those statements that you've just said, they are damaging, aren't they?
100%, because...
What does man up even mean? You know...
I actually, to be honest, I find that statement offensive. I think it's so demeaning, because it sort of says that what your feelings are irrelevant.
Yeah.
Your feelings are not important. These things that matter to you on an emotional level should be ignored, are irrelevant, and that you should just, you know, grow a pair. I mean, really think about the phrase grow a pair.
Yeah.
You know, have some balls. They're the most fragile things on the human anatomy. You just flick one and the person is out for the count. You know? Yeah. So why is that, you know...
It's important that we look at these things, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I just think back, and I mean, it's a systemic problem.
Mm.
When you think back on sort of the cloud of repression that we as Ireland as a nation in particular. I mean, I only speak as an Irish person because I'm Irish. You know, I know this is for the whole world needs to sort of cop onto this, but Ireland in particular, where it's like my grandparents on my mother's side, my mother's parents, they were, you know, devout Roman Catholics, you know, and so it was the rhythm method, contraception was, you know, that's, you know, flies in the face of Jesus. So
yeah, yeah.
They're out of the way. So my grandmother, my mum's mum, she was pregnant for, I'd say, over 20 years in a row, you know. And she lost babies. And, you know, they're buried out on unconsecrated ground outside, you know, where the family plots are, because they're, you know, so they're on a systemic level that these babies that mean so much to mums more so in those days. But I kind of question my granddad going off to the pub every evening. What was he suffering, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but I'd say he bloody did,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he loved his kids. You know, he loved his kids. He loved his grandkids. I was one of his grandkids. I know how much he loved us, you know.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine the torture that he must have gone through as well. That, you know, and men, you know, food was my thing. It could be alcohol for someone else. It could be sex for another. It could be violence. It could be whatever way you, whatever it is you use to
numb.
To numb the pain, to get through it, to burst through it, to ignore it, to put a band-aid on it, when the last thing you'd think of doing is just openly talking about how you feel. And that's what we're told not to do?
Yeah.
Fuck off, society. No, I, excuse my language, but I am done with shutting up, because it was destroying me. And my philosophy now is to speak up, not man up, because manning up is bullshit.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I sat at a table after 7 years of this where I became like morbidly obese from the amount of food I was taking in. I mean, I wasn't, you know, Mr. Svelte or anything prior to that. You know, I was the middle-aged spread kind of came in and I didn't really look after myself that well. I was just a normal bloke, just a normal overweight bloke. And, you know, as you get older, weight kind of stays on you.
Yeah, yeah.
Not something I ever really bothered with. I was never Mr. Athlete or anything like that. So I just kind of took it as it came. And then as you're putting on weight, it's a weird thing, because you blame the washing machine for shrinking your T-shirts. You blame the clothing manufacturers for mislabeling things. You blame anything but yourself,
yeah.
You know, holding on to visceral fat. You know, it's a funny thing. It's like it happens so subtly and so gradually over time, you know, and gets to the point where you just don't want to catch your reflection in the mirror, you know, because you don't like what you're seeing. And it's not the aesthetic thing, it's what it means, because the morbid obesity for me, and I can only speak on for myself, morbid obesity was a physical manifestation of my depression, 100%. There's no two bones about it. And until I met a group of men in a bereaved father's group that was put on by a little Lifetime. They were a crowd that I became aware of back in 2011 after Hank passed. I think we were given some leaflets. I mean, there was a lot of confusion around that time, you know, and there was a lot of help offered. And I do remember hearing about them, but I didn't think that was for me. You know, I didn't think it was anything that would suit me. For whatever reason, I can't really put my finger on why I avoided any kind of care or help or therapy. Maybe it was just how I saw or heard those words. They just didn't sit right with me. And they, you know, group hugs and touchy-feely or whatever it is. And I don't know what made me avoid them for so long until after 7 years of absolute self-destruction. I heard of a dad's only group, and they had dad's only in capital letters.
Yeah.
And just to draw the attention, and it drew my attention. And what they had noticed when they were putting on their sort of group therapy sessions for couples, they noticed that the dads who showed up in these environments were there to support the mum.
Yeah.
And the mum would speak openly. The mums would speak openly, and very rarely, if ever, the man would speak up. So very astutely, they decided, you know, we need to address this and put on a dad's only group. And when I found out about that, it really spoke to me. And I thought, that's appealing. Mm. And I remember writing an email to find out what the address was and where it was on and that kind of thing. And as soon as I hit send, I burst into tears.
Yeah.
Because I realized I was taking a step in a direction where I hadn't gone for so long, and it was out of my comfort zone. And then my heart beating so hard when I got the reply, and just the courage to get out of that comfort bubble that I had found myself in. I really locked myself away for those 7 years. You know, I was sitting on my arse clicking a mouse and, you know, hiding away and not being social and just getting unhealthy and sick. And it was, again, it was a manifestation of my mental state, you know,
sure.
Because
yeah, yeah.
I wasn't able to articulate or acknowledge what it was that I was going through. And pulled up outside their premises. And again, I just, these waves of tears would come, you know, going, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. I go home, I'll go home. But something I can't articulate compelled me to continue going forward. So I opened the car door, put the keys in my pocket, rang the doorbell, and I'm like, keep going. And they welcomed me in. It was all great. And I'm like, you know, it was like their voices were underwater, you know, the welcoming. I'm like, okay. And there was a big round table and I sat at it. And we laugh about it now, the lads in the group. They said one foot was under the table, the other foot was out the door. You know, mm-hmm. The way I was sitting, my body language, I was like ready to run.
Yeah.
You know, I was not comfortable there. My head was down and all these other guys sat around the table and they began the meeting with one guy who, he begins every meeting just by recounting his story from, it's close to 20 years ago, thereabouts. And as he told his story, my head sunk down into my chest and I wanted to leave, because what he was saying was like so real and true and honest and raw. And I could relate to every letter he was saying.
Mm.
I was like, that's You did that. I know that. I know that. You know that. I know that. Oh, my God. I can't be here. I can't be home. But I fought myself to stay seated. I fought myself to stay there till the end of the story. And then what happened during that first meeting is that everyone took turns recounting their story. And it came to my turn, and I couldn't speak. It was just everything that I repressed for 7 years. Just, I couldn't breathe. It was just fighting it, just tears, and just, you know, I can't even find the words to explain it, but it was like an exorcism. You know, it was just all these raw emotions coming out of me. And Peter, who was leading it, just said, it's okay, and we can come back to you if you're not ready. And I was like, go to the next guy. I went to the next guy, Keith, and they all took turns. And as everyone spoke, I realized that everyone was telling the exact same story. The character names were different, the events were different, the dates were different, the names were different, but at its core, we were all telling the same story. And it was at that moment I realized I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And that's what was killing me. I don't, for over those 7 years, I knew intellectually that I couldn't possibly be the only dad to have experienced infant loss, but emotionally, that's how I felt. I thought I was completely alone in the world until I met these guys. And it was just profound, cathartic, and I left that meeting smiling and laughing, you know. Wow. Just joyful. I felt so much lighter.
Yeah.
You know, I was still morbidly obese at that point, but wow, it was just unbelievable.
And you were part of something.
Huh?
You were part of something.
Yeah. I was just this secret group.
Yeah.
This little secret group of people that nobody wants to be a member of. Jesus, to qualify to be a member of this group, no way. I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
Sure.
But there was the guy who was next to me, Keith, who's become one of my closest friends. You know, he just put his hand on my shoulder at the end of that. And he says, just make sure you come to the next one.
Yeah.
And I kept my promise. And it took a year for me to meet him again, because it's the way the group is designed. It's that free, you can dip in and out of it. There's no mad commitment. It's there as an anchor for people. If you need to come in, you come in. And so I didn't see Keith for another year. And at that point, when he met me again, he didn't know who I was. And I remembered him.
Yeah.
I said, Keith, I've been wanting, because that just that simple little gesture of putting a hand on a shoulder. Just a simple little sentence, make sure you come back. Just sort of throw away.
And you know, it's funny you say that, because there is such a power in touch.
Yeah, there's weight to it.
Isn't there?
There's so much weight to it, yeah.
And I think we've been so deprived of that during this time.
Big time, yeah. We
know a lot of us are craving that. I certainly miss it massively. I miss that connection with people. Because sometimes you don't have to say a word, but reaching out a hand, someone or like that, putting your hand on somebody's shoulder just to kind of give them that reassurance or the feeling that you're there for them is very powerful.
It means a lot, yeah.
So there was that connection or bond in a relatively short time.
Instant, because we had been through the war.
Yeah.
We knew exactly what. And the weird thing is that I meet parents with kids all the time, and I never remember the kids' names.
But I
always remember the names of their lost baby. I don't know what it is. It's a weird thing. So, Mia, just, you know, back in January, she would have turned 3, and I went out and did a run for her, you know, just because I know how much she means to him, my friend Keith, and, you know, and what he means to me just for that simple little gesture is just... Yeah. You know, and I think that's what we need. We're like, even just in that instance of just bereaved fathers group, is that we're stronger together.
Yeah.
And that radiates outwards, you know, to the whole world. We are stronger together, and to fight against each other is just it's. You know, it's destroying each other. It's destroying the planet. It's destroying, you know, you can.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Expand and expand and expand, but at its core, it's just people connecting.
Yes.
And that's what we need fundamentally in society, is people connecting.
I agree wholeheartedly. So that first night, meeting Keith and then meeting him again a year later, and you saying that he didn't recognise you. The reason he didn't recognise you is that you had gone through a transformation, and not just a physical one, on every level. So who was the Ian he met a year later?
Oh, that's a good question. There's so many layers to that, I guess.
Sure.
In what happened in that 1 year, I mean, on a superficial level, I lost half my body weight, but that's not why I.
Of course.
You know, it was never for aesthetics. It was never for vanity. It was just I needed to. I needed to be the best dad I could be for Hank's older brother Ike. I remember lying in bed at night, where you're completely relaxed. You're in bed at night. Expelling any energy. You're not doing anything cardio. You're not doing anything like that. And I was lying completely flat and relaxed on my back, and noticed that I was kind of just wobbling and pulsing, and, you know, like the flesh of my belly was kind of wobbling, you know, and it's a weird thing to admit. It's very, but I noticed, well, it's my heart was just struggling so hard to just pump blood around my body to keep me alive, because I was killing it. And, you know, Ike was about to turn 10, I guess, at the time, and he was in the next room, and I just thought, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And it came from the core of my very essence of my being that I'm going to die. Like, it was told to me by a doctor a few years earlier than that, you know, you're not going to live to see 50 the way you're, you know, the way you, if you don't make some kind of change. She was trying to determine what, you know, what, blood pressure medication to put me on for the rest of my life. And I'm like, no, I'm not, no way. And I never went back, you know, because I was so, you know, depression really stops you thinking rationally. It stops you, it makes you hide.
Were you in denial?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was like, ignore it and it'll go away.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, you know, you're driving a car and there's someone in the passenger seat and you take a corner too fast and the person in the passenger seat gets scared and goes, I think you better slow down. And you're like, I'm grand. I'm driving. It's all good. But if you take the same corner yourself and it comes from within, oh, I better slow down because I nearly, you know, it's only then that you listen.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing in the human mind that, it, you know, unless it comes from within, you really not, it's so easy to dismiss and not pay attention to it. And it was like a wake-up call when I just realized I'm going to die. And it was so upsetting that I just thought, no, this is, it's all real. Fuck, it's all real. Mm. I got to do something and and yeah, I just this was about this was actually about a week or thereabouts before that father's meeting, so that really sort of, you know, it was like getting a gravity assist, like a rocket ship getting a gravity assist from another planet and shooting off into the, you know, like Voyager heading off out into the cosmos. So so that dad's group really helped propel me forwards, you know, and I was like, right, I've got some meaning behind this now. It's not just like a health emergency. I've got some meaning and emotion behind this. And every single day was just like, I don't call it weight loss. I call it health gain, because that's what I was fighting for, was gaining my health back. And you know, the sort of superficial, you know, weight loss. I mean, it was nice to get compliments, you know, on a superficial level. Who doesn't like compliments about your appearance? But that's not what I was fighting for my life. You know, I wasn't out to, you know, fit into a nice suit so I could attend a wedding and look good in the photos. I was fighting for my life. Yeah. And because, you know, I just thought my dad around my age at that time, I was 20 when he nearly died of a massive coronary. And that's where I was heading.
Right.
Was a massive coronary. So heart disease was in my family. And I remember coming back. I was in Dublin in college. I went back home to see him. Sitting in the hospital bed, this sort of sunken grey man after, you know, he survived, obviously, and he's still with us.
Yeah, great.
And, you know, amazing man. But I felt like my rock was crumbling, you know, and I was 20. I was an adult and I was like, felt like a little 10-year-old boy. I'm losing my dad. And, you know, it was so upsetting to see him like that. But, you know, he survived, all good. But I just thought, like, Christ, Ike is 10 years younger than I was at that point. I don't want to do that to him. So in a very weird way, he saved my life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I think that's lovely. Because I owe both my boys my life. Because, you know, like when I, you know, I lost half my body weight in a very short period of time. It's about 8-9 months or thereabouts. Like I was over 350 pounds, like at my heaviest. Like fat guys don't like to go on weighing scales. We don't want really, you know, you don't want to know how much you weigh. You get to a certain point and it's like, I'm not going on the weighing scales anymore. So it could have been a lot more, but I know BMI is rubbish
Yeah.
I was still in the late 40s of a BMI, so that easily put me into the category of morbidly obese. So all the health conditions about that, you know, hypertension and pre-diabetic and, you know, just destroying myself. So the weird thing was is that once that sort of weight loss occurred, again, health gain occurred. Mm. It just made me feel better. Not talking about aesthetics or anything like that, but just going out and being able to walk without being out of breath, to put on socks without sweating, with a red beetroot face. Simple little things like that. And just like, geez, I need to, my belt, I need to put an extra hole in this. And so I was never getting on the scale. It was all these, like, oh, I haven't worn this T-shirt in 20 years. It fits, you know. That kind of gives you a little bit of confidence, a little bit of self-esteem kind of starts to rise up a little bit. And, I was out walking my dog November, I guess, 2018. It was May. It's actually today. I told you that earlier.
Yeah, actually, for those listening, because I didn't want to cut across you, but I do find it interesting. It's happened a number of times on conversations I've had where there is a significance to a date that I'm oblivious to, but the universe works in our own mysterious ways.
Yes, yes.
But you were talking to me about the significance of May 17th, and today is Monday, May 17th. So can you share that with us?
It's 3 years since I sat down to that breakfast where I was determined to save my life. 3 years to the day.
Wow.
So, I mean, I can go into what the last 3 years were.
Yeah, yeah.
Next, because I guess that's the next chapter, isn't it? I suppose in the story, because something really profound happened that November, walking my dog, just feeling lighter in my own body, in my own mind, just sort of fresher. I mean, I love being out in nature anyway, and I just, living in Meath, there's a lot of, it's a very flat county, so there's a lot of bogland and things like that, and nature reserves, and, you know, a lot of sort of wildlife, and I like being wild and out in life, you know, and so I was out walking my dog. She's great because, you know, she's part husky, so she needs to get out a lot, so that keeps you going. And it was a day like that where I was walking along with her, and she's sprinting back and forth, and I was just messing with her, and I just, this, it's hard to describe, because, and I hope I never find the right words for this, and I hope I never distill what this feeling is. I just want to let it be what it was, but it was a compulsion to run, and I ran. And it was only for a few seconds, but Jesus, I felt like I was like a little baby boy. I just felt like I was flying. It was awful terrain, big potholes and things like that. It's around the circumference of bog, so it's not exactly a manicured path or anything like that. So I ran along, and there was a big dip, and I jumped over it. I hadn't jumped in probably 20 years, and honestly, I felt like I was flying. It was incredible. And I just started laughing. I'm alone on a bog, like, you know, a 40-odd-year-old man running with his dog, laughing on a bog. It's just, you know, if anyone saw me, it was like, who's this nutbag, you know? But it just awoke this sort of childlike zest for life within me. And, you know, you've a kid, you know, you bring them out into nature, they see a green field and boom, they're gone like a bullet. You know, run, you know, they're gone.
Totally.
And that's what awoke inside me, you know, this childlike feeling. And in a very real way, it just connected me with Hank. It really just it awoke something, you know, that love that hit me that day when he was born. It just sizzled it, you know, it gave it spark, you know. I was just thinking, I wasn't doing anything. I said, I'm not going to suppress this. I'm just going to go with it, you know. And I went to the sports shop, like a place where I'm Mr. Imposter. I never felt comfort in that environment, you know. And I went in, I found the cheapest pair of running shoes I could find on sale. You know, they were like 22 quid. I thought, well, I'm not going to tell anybody about this, and just take them home. And I hid them, didn't show them to anybody. And I said, you know, it's 22 quid. If I end up not using these and they end up in the bin, it's not that big an investment. I'm not spending 150 quid on some posh Altras or anything like that. So so what I did was, and this is funny, there's an industrial estate near where I live. And after 6 o'clock, it's a wasteland, you know, because it's a dead end. So there's nobody there. And I was still pretty large at this point. You know, I wasn't Mr. Athlete or anything like that. Not that I am now or anything. But I went down there and I started to teach myself how to run by running for 10 seconds at a time, walking for 30 seconds, running for 10 seconds, walking for 10 seconds. And just to chase that feeling of youth, the childness. Not youth as such, but that childlike feeling.
Yeah.
And I started to build up and build up just over time. And I'd go out in the evening. And the funny thing is this is where I would go to have those sneaky chipper chips, you know. This is where I'd go to gorge myself. So I was going, you know, doing something very different.
Wow, that's
interesting. So I was hidden away, doing something very different to what I was doing hidden away, you know, earlier than that.
But the difference, I suppose, was that first sitting in the car, you know, eating the chips was the byproduct of that was not good for you. Whereas this one was actually the yeah. absolute opposite, which is
there's no driving home with the windows open to get rid of the smell of vinegar, so you won't get caught out in that scenario, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the fear as well of getting caught. It was very, you know, that's addictive behavior. You're hiding. Like, I got to get out to a different bin. You drive somewhere else to find a bin to dispose of stuff, you know, so you're not putting it in the refuse in the house. It's a real, it's not a good way to be.
Yeah. And there'll be people listening to this who are in that right now, who are, you know, listening to you going, this is my life, you know. So the amount of people that you can, I feel, potentially and positively impact is huge. Because you're not just speaking to people who are bereaved parents. You're also speaking to people who have, you know, suffering with their mental health. I always imagine the people listening and who they might be. And I just feel there's a lot of suffering and a lot of pain, particularly in this time, that there's a lot of secrecy and a lot of isolation happening. And people are trapped in whatever's going on for them. So by you speaking so openly, it's hugely beneficial. But yeah, so just polar opposite, so different.
Big time, yeah. And yeah, I kept going at it, because I gave myself little goals.
Did you?
And I think that's the secret, is to, you know, nobody stands at the foot of Everest and goes, right, oh, that's going to be easy.
Yeah,
They stand there and they're overwhelmed.
Mm.
They want to run away. But no, you just put one foot in front of the other. Let's get the base camp first. Let's get the lay of the land. Let's acclimatize. Let's get the right clothes. Let's go shopping first and get the right prepare, you know?
Mm.
And that's a lot of what I did. I kind of became like an autodidact. I went into the science of nutrition, our circadian rhythms, you know, eating seasonally, all that kind of stuff, you know? And you really have to be your own frontline healthcare worker, you know, because healthcare, not to demean or discourage or anyone from going to doctors and stuff like that, but it seems to be more like sick care than healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of treat the symptoms but never address the cause. And if they do address the cause, it's easily ignored, like I did. I walked out of there going, like, I walked out of the doctor's office and never went back.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to put me on drugs for the rest of my life, and I wasn't having any of that. But, like, what's the alternative? The alternative is to save yourself.
That's it.
You are your frontline care worker. You have to take responsibility.
Mm.
If you are going down a path of destruction, there's nobody's going to save you but yourself. Superman isn't going to fly in and make everything okay. There's no magic pill. It's all down to personal accountability and responsibility. And that's a tough sell.
Yeah, it is.
That is a tough sell, because it seems overwhelming. But do your research. I'm still not at the top of Everest, but I'm on my way there, you know, because I did the research, because I became my own frontline healthcare worker, if that makes any sense.
It totally does. It totally does. But I mean, do we ever get to the top either? Do you know what I mean? I think that's part of life. You're constantly growing, learning, taking two steps forward, 10 back, or one step back, 10 forward.
There is no top of Everest. The top of Everest is when you breathe your last breath.
That's it, correct.
But, you know, do you want to hide for the rest of your life, or do you want to embrace life?
Yeah.
Do you want to have that adventure? Do you want to try and at least get to the top of Everest? Because every day is magic when you have an adventure to look forward to, you know? And that's kind of where I find myself in the trajectory of right now, fueled by the gift that Hank gave me. It took me a long time to unwrap it, but the gift he gave me is just so, I can't think of anything more profound, is to have him in my heart beating with me every day. And it's not like I'm living for him or anything like that, but he's just a part of my life, you know, as you know, I'm sitting here now, and both my boys aren't present with me, but it doesn't stop me loving them both right now.
Yes.
One's alive, one's dead. That's a different aspect. But in my heart, I'm the father of two boys.
Yes.
I always will be, you know, and that's, you know, I think having that power of fatherhood, the power of the love I have for Hank, and also the love I have for Ike, in how he made me take a long, hard look at myself lying in bed that night when I realized I am going to die. Those doctors are right. And yeah, just it opened the floodgates. It really opened the floodgates. I mean, running, like I went from running for 10 seconds at a time around this industrial estate. And then a couple of months ago, on the other side of that wall, I always heard them every now and again, this cacophony, because they're on the other side of that wall is Claremont Stadium in Navan Town. And when the floodlights were on, I'm on the other side going around this dark and dingy industrial estate. That's the place where I ran 10 marathons in 10 days.
When you say that.
So from running for 10 seconds at a time to running 10 marathons in 10 days. In 2 and a bit years, I think it took between those two events. See, this, the thing is,
that sounds like Guinness Book of Records.
I know it sounds incredible, I know it sounds amazing, but there's nothing amazing about me at all. Everyone's got this within them.
Okay, I know what you're saying, but it's still a phenomenal.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
This is a thought experiment. This is completely hypothetical. You're out in the Australian outback. You have a little boy. Yeah. I don't mean to get too personal, but you have a little boy.
Yeah, yeah.
You're out in the Australian outback. He's bitten by a snake. He can't be moved because the venom will go through his system quicker. So he has to stay there. The medicine is 13.1 miles that way. Uh-huh. You're going to get there as fast as you can. You're going to get that medicine and you're going to get back quick as you possibly can. It won't be pretty. You'll be a mess. You'll be exhausted. You'll be fucked by the time you get there. But you will do whatever you can to get back there and give him that medicine, won't you?
Yeah, totally.
And you would do that every day if you had to, wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
10 marathons in 10 days is nothing. You've got it in you. Everyone's got it in you. It's the power of love.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't mean to say anything to upset you, but it's a thought experiment.
No, it's beautiful. It's, yeah. And I hear you. I hear you completely.
We've all got it in us.
Yeah. And it's not until we're tested that we realise what we're capable of.
Mm. And don't, like, I ran 10 marathons in 10 days, but, like, I'm not fast. I was a mess at the end of every one. I was, you know, like, don't, I'm not fucking, you know, Eamon Coughlin or any of those, you know, Kipoje or any of those guys. I'm just a regular dude who, you know, decided to run because it means something. To me, I get a lot of value.
It's your why.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And if anyone asks me why I run these ridiculous distances, I hope I never find out why. Mm-hmm. I think Darrow O'Brien has this great joke where he says, if science knew everything, it would stop. You know?
Yeah.
And I figure if I ever figure out why I'm compelled to run these distances, I'll stop. And I don't ever want to find out why.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I'd love to go back to is the year later, meeting Keith, and that when you said he didn't, you know, it took him a while to realise you were that chap he met a year ago. How did that go?
It was a meeting. It was his first meeting since then.
Yeah,
I went to every one of them in the interim, and every time I went there, I was hoping to bump into him again.
Yeah, okay.
Because I wanted to thank him.
Yeah,
I know it was a kind of a throwaway kind of. Almost meaningless gesture, but it meant so much to me. And I owed him a debt of gratitude. I just wanted to shake his hand and say, thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah.
For what you did. That was just, you know, simple. It's just the simplest little things that just have so much weight and value, you know?
Absolutely. Sometimes we can meet people for a very short time and they can have a profound impact on your life that in that moment he did.
Yeah.
And you can know people your entire life and they won't have the same... impact on you. So I get that entirely.
Yeah.
So did you say that to him when you met him?
It was in the meeting and he arrived late.
Yeah.
And we were already talking and I was in the middle of being asked a question by Peter. This is Peter Hamlin. He's a bereavement counsellor who leads these meetings for a little lifetime. Great, great man. And I got to finish my thought and I turned to Keith then and just said, here, Keith, before we go anywhere else, I need to tell you, I'm really grateful for what you did. It meant so much, this, that and the other. And he's looking at me going like, who's this guy?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And I could see him being confused. And I said, it's Ian. I sat next to you, like about a year ago. He says, I don't. And then I just remember seeing the look in his face of shock. And he goes, that's you? Yeah. And I kind of felt a little embarrassed then. I was almost kind of covering myself up a bit, kind of going, I got better. Thanks. No, it was, he said, you look like that guy who writes Game of Thrones. That's what you used to look like. And he wouldn't stop about, look at you. And I'm like, because I'm very self-conscious anyway. Okay. And, and any kind of attention like that is a bit weird, especially having been fat for so long. Is that and kind of body dysmorphia kind of does haunt me.
Yeah.
Okay. There's when you lose that amount of body weight, and especially so rapidly.
And what was it, if you don't mind me asking, at that point?
It was, I got down to 200 pounds. No, I got down to 198 was the lowest I got. I'm now about 210.
Yeah.
And it was 350. Plus, I that's where I stopped weighing myself at 350.
Yeah.
So it could have been a lot more. So that's in stones. I think that's about 10 or 11 stone.
Yeah. In a year.
Yeah.
And that was really, that wasn't
less
just
than a year, actually.
Wow. Yeah. So it was a combination of the running, but also the food. You tackled it all.
The running came towards the end of that. It was about 8 months in. I started on. I didn't do a tap. It was all to do with my relationship with food.
Mm.
Because you can't outrun a bad diet, you know?
Yeah.
You can't outrun the McDonald's. You can't outrun the chips. You know, you have to, food, and my relationship with food, more importantly, was what I had to address.
And did you get extra help with that? Because it just sounds like you were going from a place of being, like, very stuck in a certain way of behaving to utter transformation. You did it yourself?
I did it, yeah, alone.
Wow, that's really impressive.
It was... It's because of that night when it came from within.
Yeah.
I knew it was an emergency and I knew I had to take responsibility and I knew there was nobody else who could do this. You got to dial in what works for yourself. You got to do your research and you got to sort of make yourself a guinea pig in a sense and find out what works for you, because we're all different, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I subsist on a completely whole food, plant-based eating protocol right now. I don't call it a diet, because I think what the success was is I quit dieting 3 years ago today.
Great.
I stopped dieting. Dieting is bullshit. Dieting is a multi-billion-dollar industry because it sets people up to fail, because all they want is your repeat custom. Dieting is cruel and it's not the right way to eat.
Mm.
I don't want to go off on a rant now about it. But
that's a very important message.
I think it really sets up people to fail, and it's temporary.
Yeah.
You know, you get to a certain point, I'll do this for 2 months, I'll do this for 3 months. But no, what really needs to happen is a lifestyle change.
Mm-hmm. Consistency.
And that's what I did 3 years ago, is to just change my attitude towards food, what I identified as food, and what I use as fuel.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of pleasure you can get out of food, but ultimately what it is fuel for your body to burn energy. That moment of sensual pleasure you get on the tongue and the palate is fleeting, but it remains in your system and fuels and feeds your system for a long time after that sensuous pleasure subsides. So you've kind of got to weigh up what's more important, you know, that delicious slice of pepperoni pizza, or what it's going to do to you for hours and hours afterwards.
So again, going back to the running from, you know, the few seconds at a time and then building up to minutes and then longer. When did you, like, what was the progression from that to running a longer distance to then tackling a marathon and now, you know, that jump into the ultra?
Yeah. I didn't really have a goal when I went out teaching myself to run. I just thought, I need to learn how to run.
Mm.
I just wanted to run for a sustained period of time. So I was running for 10 seconds, walking for 30, and I built up to 30, then walking for 10. You know, just slowly but surely. I mean, you don't go out and do it straight away. You got to do it for sure. And I was only doing that for like 10 minutes one night, maybe 15 the next night, you know, and taking a day off in between. You know, you don't again, you don't get even go to base camp until you buy the clothes in the shop first. Mm. So it was then I went to a thing in Navan. I think they have them all over Ireland. It's called Men on the Move. Okay. I think that's what it was called. It's like, healthy exercise thing for men in their 40s kind of thing. So it was at that I learned of the park run.
Okay, yeah.
That goes on, well, doesn't stop now, but hopefully it'll be back soon. But the park run, which is the 5K run all around the country every Saturday. And I thought, okay, 5K, can I do that? And that was a goal in mind then. So the first Saturday in December was on its way, the park run. I said, right, I put that in my calendar and I get myself ready to do the park run 5K. But I don't want to show up not being able to cover the 5K distance. I was, you know, I'm an introvert and I suffer from anxiety and I don't like to, you know... Mm. I want to be prepared before I do it. You know, my philosophy really is, you know, prepare, you know, I think as Benjamin Franklin said, if you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail.
Yeah. Or Roy Keane. Don't be polite to say
that's
it's Roy Keane's
I said that to my dad there recently. He's, oh yeah, Roy Keane. And I said, no, it's Benjamin Franklin.
Another fellow said it before. Yeah, it's Roy Keane.
Yeah, so where was it? Yeah, the park run.
The park run, yeah.
Yeah, I learned that at the Man on the Move thing. And I, okay, that's it. And it's every Saturday. And it's free. Okay, if it's free, then sign me up. Yeah. And it says, you have to go online, get a barcode, this, that, and the other. Okay, I'll do that. So I went out to the industrial estate with my app. And the app I was using was called Zombies Run.
Okay.
Like a couch to 5K thing, but was with zombies. You know, so the zombies would chase you. You'd hear them in your headphones.
No way.
You know, to make, oh, here comes your 10-second sprint, and you hear the, you know, whatever
and
works.
And it worked.
It was, yeah, it was fun. It made it a bit more enjoyable rather than just, you know, because some of the other apps are very doesn't appeal to, the nerd in me.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Zombies is much more fun rather than some svelte athlete going, come on!
Okay.
You know, you're grand. No, I'd rather have a zombie chase me, thanks. Because zombies don't run anyway. So. So, I went out and a week beforehand, I had about 3 weeks before then, and about a week beforehand, I went out and I was always including my front doors, I had to finish at my front door. I wasn't going to take one step further than I needed to, you know. So I was always, my front door was the start point and the end point, you know. So when I'd go out, I'd include that. So I went out and started running. And the person in my headphones said, right, you can walk now. And I just said, no, I'll do that the next. I'll keep going until the next one. The person said, okay, you can walk now. I said, no, I'm going to keep going. And I didn't want to stop. I said, no, I'm going to get to 5K. This is going to happen tonight. I feel it. Mm. I'm just going to keep going until I reach 5K. And it just felt brilliant because I think a few days before that, I went out and walked the dog and measured 5 kilometers walking. Mm. And I remember coming home from going, how the fuck am I supposed to run that distance? And I'm knackered from walking it, you know? And so I showed up at the first park run and they have this thing, is any newcomers put your hands up? And I'm like, no, you're grand.
Yeah.
So I hid down the back and stayed down the back. But I finished that park run and what I found was that the people there were just so welcoming.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm driving to the park run and there was people running to the park run. Mm. And I'm like, what are you running before going for a run for? You know, it's like... this is mad. I saw I'm in out of my head. And again, that fight or flight thing that like same as being outside the Bereaved Fathers meeting. I was just saying, I wanted to turn around and go back home.
Yeah,
No, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I said, no, I've been experiencing a lot of benefits in my life, but by getting out of my comfort zone, let's try this. Let's just park the car and maybe get out. And again, I was like, I didn't go straight to the start line. I said, are I going to find the race director or the parkrun director? And I talked to him. I was like, this is my first time. What do I do?
Yeah.
You know, and he was really friendly, really nice. And I finished that first parkrun. And I'm talking about 40-minute 5Ks. You know, I'm not, you know.
But you did it.
Mr. Athlete. Yeah, this is it.
So talk to me about the September. It's a big month.
Yeah, it's the month. I turned 50 this month. And this is the birthday I was told by the doctor that, you know, the way I was going, I wasn't going to live to see 50. Mm. And I, to be honest, I can't believe it myself, because, you know, a year after sitting down to that breakfast, I ran my first marathon, and then I ended up running like 5 marathons that year. 2020 came, the year of lockdown, and I started running ultra distances, and I just, because it seemed impossible, you know, and I just kept going and going and going. And then this September, I'm turning 50, a year that I wasn't expected to live to see, and I've signed up for the Kerryway Ultra, which is Ireland's longest and most brutal trail race, which is 200 kilometres around the Ivory Peninsula.
I didn't realise it was that long. How long?
200 kilometres, which is about 130 miles.
Am I right in thinking that ultras can vary in length?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They start out about 50 kilometres.
Is your basic. 50,
yeah, which is...
which is huge.
An ultra, by definition, is anything longer than a marathon.
Yeah, all right, okay.
But it's not like walking back to the car park after you finish your marathon. You can't include the extra 100 metres. It has to be something substantial. So it's 50K is typically the shortest ultra marathon. Then 50 miles. Then... what's next after that? 50 miles, then 100 kilometres, then 100 miles, and they can go up to 200, and then multi-day events. You know,
this is
my biggest challenge yet. The furthest I've run is 50 miles,
yeah,
and that was a barefoot marathon, or ultra marathon I did last September, which was
barefoot. Yeah.
I'm glad I did it. I'm not going to do it again.
What were your feet like afterwards?
They were quite swollen for about a week afterwards. Wow. Yeah. But my victory essentially is standing at the starting line of the Kerryway Ultra with the pistol about to go.
Mm.
That's my victory. Anything that happens after that is unwritten. I've no idea if I don't make it to the end, if I don't make the cutoff. I got to stand at the starting line, and that blows me away.
Yeah.
That is so important to me, because I wasn't supposed to be able to even be alive.
Mm.
And I'm, and it's not out of bravado or sort of ego or look what, aren't I amazing? And the fact is that we're all fucking amazing. We've all got this ability within us, and I've just decided to stop suppressing, stop overthinking, and just going with whatever compels you to move forward, because that's, like I said, the YOLO thing.
Yeah.
Run with open arms and embrace life, embrace adventure. This is what we evolved to be. Bipedal primates.
Mm.
We are evolved to move, you know? And I encourage just anyone listening to just get out and take your shoes off and walk around a beautiful lawn of green grass and just feel nature, because we are nature.
Exactly. Yeah. You're such an inspiration. I've absolutely loved and found this conversation to be incredibly profound. And thank you for being here and for giving so much of yourself to help other people. Can we support what you're doing? Because I know that you are... hashtag running for Hank. This is the reason.
Yeah.
How can we help?
I appreciate, again, the invitation and your kind words right there. It really means a lot, and thank you. As for help, yeah, I've been doing a bunch of different fundraisers over the world. I find, you know, people really pay attention to you when you run stupid distances, so why not direct that attention onto something important? And what's important to me right now is I'm a filmmaker by trade, and what I'm attempting to do at the minute is to raise funds for a documentary film. I call it Survived By.
Mm.
And it's an intimate portrait of infant loss from the perspective of dads. And it's made by bereaved fathers, for bereaved fathers, and of course if anyone else gets derives benefit from watching the film. I'm trying to raise 10 grand, which is typically what like the Screen Ireland Film Board would give as development funding. I've decided I would rather do this grassroots rather than get a production company involved or funding from government bodies, whatever, because things kind of get distilled. And I don't want this to end up being in a very sort of I want this to be real and as honest and as truthful and from the heart as I can possibly make it. I want to make it honest and genuine. Mm. And the only way I can do that is to appeal to people to help me make it and make it the right way and not in a, you know, throwaway human interest kind of distilled kind of way. Mm. I think that's... And yeah, runningforhank.com/10-10-10. It's named after the 10 marathons in 10 days. And I'm still running a marathon a month, every month for the rest of the year. So another 10 marathons in addition to the 10 wow. I ran in January, just to keep the momentum going.
Yeah, and, yeah. You'll be well oiled by September. So
yeah.
Well, look, the link will be in the show notes. And please, if you've connected with Ian and his experience, please support what he's doing, because I think it's really important. And thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
It's been an absolute honour to talk to you. Thanks for listening.
Likewise. Thank you. If you like this podcast, please show your support by leaving a rating or a comment on Apple and by clicking follow on Spotify. I'd be so grateful. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.